Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Before we begin, a reminder that you can sign up to my daily Red Box email telling you everything that's going on in politics for free at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. Now, we live in challenging times. A hung parliament, the news full of terror and tragedy, Brexit in doubt, the Prime Minister clinging on, and it's just so damn hot. Here to take the political temperature on this week's episode, Jenny Russell, who says Brexit is already a mess. Ian Martin thinks he knows who should be the next Prime Minister. But first, Anne Ashworth, the Times property editor, on the lessons that must be learnt from the Grenfell Tower fire.
The Grenfell Tower disaster has revealed that our building safety regulation may have some very shaky foundations. How are we still unable to determine whether the cladding used at this building was banned or not banned? As this new aspect of the housing crisis is exposed, we need a Secretary of State for Housing who is a member of Cabinet, and we need that person now.
No, and obviously our thoughts with all the people who are caught up in it, and the sadly the death toll is still likely to rise. But quite quickly the conversation moved on to how on earth this could have happened, and this focus on cladding. How confident should we be that the cladding was the problem?
Well, I think the most worrying aspect of this is that nobody really seems to know. There's a complex interplay of roles, of regulation, of certification in any building process, but there doesn't seem to be a clear trail of what decisions were made at this building and how. And I talk to an awful lot of people who are in development, and they are just obsessed with how things went wrong. And one of them said to me last night, there was a perfect storm of things that went wrong at this building, but why do we not know more? And some of them are really personally quite hurt that people do not seem to have taken their jobs as seriously as they might have done. Now, but it also seems to me that no minister that has appeared to talk about this seems to have a firm grasp of the issues. Housing is too big. Why don't we have a Secretary of State for Housing? I've been calling for this for a long time. I cannot see why it isn't a cabinet role, because it's one of the biggest crises facing this country, and a new aspect of it has opened up in that we do not know whether what we're building and what we're retrofitting or renovating, whatever you call it, is being properly done.
And I think one of the... Obviously, there's been a lot of emotion and anger, which has come from what happened at Grenfell Tower. But one of the really frustrating things is just to not know it. Well, who is responsible for this? I mean, if it was my house, clearly I'm responsible for my house, but if you're living in a tower block, much of it is social housing. Is it the council? Is it the developer? Is it the landlord? Is it the people who did the work? And I think inevitably then maybe all the focus just turns to Theresa May, because, well, who else to shout at?
Well, there seems to be a long chain of deniability throughout the whole of the process, when we ought to have responsibility for what has happened. And it also seems to be quite clear that in some circumstances one can approve work done, oneself, and also an assumption, as one developer put it to me last night. He said there is the danger is that everybody assumes that somebody else down the line has done the checks, that the material is authorised. And around, I don't live that far from Grenfell, and around those streets, places are still cordoned off. But these people are really, really angry, and that's spread out throughout the country. People, even in a perfectly, beautifully renovated Victorian semi in a very nice suburb, still want to know what happened there. And I wonder if the government quite recognises the depth of emotion on this whole subject.
Ian, what have you made of the response to it and this apparent lack of accountability for, ultimately, but the safety of people in their own homes should be something that is not in doubt?
I suspect that it's going to end up being a different, in a sense, more costly, really, parallel with the banking crisis in terms of how you can have a lot of regulation, whether it's good or bad, but not really clarity on precisely who is responsible, and lots of people ticking the box and thinking that they have fulfilled their responsibility, therefore the job is done. And I think it's similar to the banking crisis in that a lot of what I'm someone who writes about that crisis, our most recent experience of something traumatic like that, a lot of it really is down to people ask why was no one punished. Why did no one go to jail? And the answer ended up being with the financial crisis, because it was all legal. Almost everything that happened that caused the crisis was legal. Now, we don't know in these circumstances. But it poses then a moral question to the whoever decided to use that cladding, whoever signed off on that cladding, whoever allowed in Whitehall as housing minister that to be used, who didn't ask very basic questions. This stuff might be legal. Is it actually a risk? And that's very similar to the banking crisis. Lots of people just sort of ploughed on doing what was legal, complying with the regulation as they saw it, ticking it, passing it down the line. And the end result in this case is not billions of pounds lost. The end result is human lives lost. And I suspect that this is going to become emblematic of austerity, a parable of austerity. And I think it's hugely politically significant. It's a moment, I think, similar to the winter of discontent for the Labour Party. And I think the cack-handed response of the Conservatives since, I think they are storing up for themselves trouble that is going to last a generation and more.
Jenny, what do you think the government could have done to react better to this? Because there has been a lot of criticism of the way that Theresa May and ministers reacted to it, but what in reality, because it's such an awful event and it's so massive, what can a politician do in the immediate aftermath of that?
I'm sort of speechless, because they did nothing, and anything would have been better, but the answer would have been so simple. I mean, I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning. I live very close to where this was happening, saw what was happening on the news, thought I could watch this from my top windows, but I don't want to stand there passively and watch people die and know that I'm just being a voyeur. And I just assumed that because this is the most powerful city in Britain, in one of the richest nations in the world, we're not talking about Syria, we're not talking about Ecuador, we're not talking about Bangladesh. I just assumed that by 6 o'clock in the morning, since I already knew it by two, that you'd have experienced disaster relief people there, that you'd ask that there'd be civil contingencies people, that there would be people there making lists and housing people and providing emergency supplies and directing people to where they should go, because my God, we've got Oxfam here, we've got Médecins Sans Frontières, all these people operate abroad, but they're all specialists, they all know how you behave in disasters. It did not occur to me for one minute that in London we would not be able to do the kind of thing that we fly into disaster zones and advise third world governments how to deal with. And I'm just profoundly shocked. I mean, I was walking around there on Saturday for several hours, and the place was heaving with volunteers and with people who'd come to offer help, and they were carrying blankets and baby food and nappies and underwear, and they were trailing around from help point to help point trying to leave this stuff, wanting to help somebody. They were being turned away at every point because there were enough donations, and one woman had a sign up saying, "We have many donations but no direction." and there was still nobody there from the council visible. There was nobody there from the government. And the place was full of desperate wishes to help and tearful people putting up bouquets saying, "To my dearest dad," and weeping at the wall, and still no sense that anybody was in charge.
How is it we haven't got a cross London Authority task force that is prepared for these emergencies? A sort of government of all the talents at all these councils, where there are surely enough professionals who know how to cope, and some provision to call in the army pretty quickly. And as people have said, we have floods, we call in the army. Was this not a situation where we should have had that?
And also, I think, you know, there's also been an awful lot of training and exercise to deal with terror attacks. And actually, that was one of the things we saw both in London Bridge, but in Manchester, how quickly those processes kick in, both with the police, but also hospitals and that sort of thing. And this just, thankfully, for a long time, the number of house fires have been going down. And that's always been one of the reasons why there have been cuts and that sort of thing. But then so people sort of end up assuming, well, this will never happen, so maybe we don't need to prepare for it. And
But they should have reacted, you're right, exactly, as if it were a terror attack. I mean, the numbers, had that been a bomb in Grenfell Tower rather than cladding, we'd have treated it differently, and we should have done.
And I think the fact that it happened at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I do question the government's response, but I think Matt makes a very important point, is that the entire focus, I mean, before this fire, police in London hadn't had a day off for 2 weeks. The whole focus has been terror. Yeah, and terror has been the defining disaster emergency question in London since the mid-2000s, and it worked. The response plan worked very well. I think what really strikes me, though, and which I think is going to have a long-lasting impact, is just how rich that council is. That is one of the richest, if not the richest, local authorities in the country. It is a country. It is a local authority that has made a fetish out of think tanks and party conference events of proving that it knows how to keep the bills down, and that it has huge surpluses, and that it encourages private development, and it is full of the richest people in the country. And when it came to it, it couldn't do the basics that any citizen expects of a local authority.
It couldn't even appear and talk to the crowds when they gather angrily at Kensington Town Hall. And when you think, you know, throughout English history, you've had young princes and kings riding out to meet peasant rebellions and making people feel that they are heard, often afterwards betraying them, but that's another subtext. And it was just profoundly shocking, because those people already feel that they have been treated like trash. And then the response to this has proved to them that society pays them no respect, and that they are not being listened to by the people in power. And I agree with you, Anne. I think the anger out there is extraordinary, and I don't think the government understands it.
So, Anne, just before we move on, you wrote in the Times on Saturday, I think, that whenever there's a disaster or tragedy like this, there are reviews and inquiries and recommendations and guidelines, and then bits fall away. And there's obviously a debate about whether or not sprinklers should have been fitted, whether or not alarms should have been fitted. There's the question of the cladding. Do you think that, because this is so appalling, that things will happen now that haven't happened before?
We always say lessons have to be learned, but the mood of the nation is such, this is such a big topic for people, that they will be looking for lessons to be learned and lessons to be implemented. And no idea that deregulation, which always sounds such a great word, will mean that all those procedures, all those safeguards are swept away because nothing has happened. I mean, the Lackanall fire in Southwark proved that there needed to be measures put in place. They were not done. My case proven, I think.
Can I just add to that, that when you look at the correspondence from the all-party parliamentary group on fire safety writing to one of the government ministers about 18 months ago saying, please, will you act on these recommendations? Mm-hmm. He's right back saying, I don't see any urgency about this. And you think, you're the housing minister. How can you think it's not urgent to stop people burning to death in tower blocks?
One of the things I thought was really striking was Sajid Javid did a media round at the end of the week, and he just sounded like somebody who just had no answers, and sort of a sudden realisation that actually this being in government is quite a big deal, you know, in a way that normally we talk about ministers being up and down and moving from department to department, isn't all a great lot of fun. Actually, there are people who have been in government who have made a decision to delay looking at those guidelines, and they will now have to be asking themselves really serious questions. And he was asked a question: how would you feel if you were putting your children to bed tonight in a tower block? And he basically said he'd feel like everyone else and wouldn't be confident in their safety, which is an appalling place for a cabinet minister to be. Yeah.
His brief's too big. Housing should be removed and it gets its own Secretary of State. I'm going to get a T-shirt. I might even get a tattoo.
Well, I'm sure it's housing is an issue that we'll come back to again. But let's move on now. Times columnist Jenny Russell taking a look at Brexit.
Yeah, we move straight on in this podcast from one mess to another one, from the one that's causing lives now to the one that's going to affect all our lives in the future. Well, we're a year on from the referendum and the government's Brexit policy is just a total muddle. Theresa May asked the country to back her vision of a hard Brexit and the electorate said no. And they took her majority away, and yet, and there's no majority in Parliament for a hard Brexit now, and the polls are turning against it. And yet Theresa May appears to be carrying on just as she was before. She's announcing no change. She's starting talks in Brussels as if she had all the authority and the power to carry it through. And this is a complete fantasy. There's a real danger that we're just going to smash out of Europe because the time for talks will run out. So we've all got to start agitating for the Chancellor's preferred alternative, which is a long transition period, perhaps of 2 to 5 years, in which we can make the trade deals and the arrangements that are going to save us from disaster.
Well, Brexit in 5 minutes. So let's, Jenny, pick up where we are right now. David Davis has been to Brussels, he's had his first day of negotiations, and he's stared them in the eyes and caved in immediately on the question of the sequencing of the debate, and we have to settle the divorce bill before we can even start talking about the rest of the
and
stuff.
The rights of EU migrants. And I have to say, this is a metaphor or an example of everything that's going to follow. There's David Davis talking so tough just before the negotiations, just saying that arguments about what we talk about when is going to be the row of the summer. So he comes up there posturing, saying, I'm going to fight. And then he gets in there and realises there are 27 of them. They're one of us. We have no cards to play. Time is running out. We've wasted 2 or 3 months of it on holding this ridiculous election, which left us weaker than before. And he immediately has to say, actually, OK, we'll do what you say, because there's no point arguing about that. There are more important things to discuss. And this is going to be our position throughout. It's an absolute illusion to think that we are strong. We aren't, because they know what they want and they're much more powerful than we are. We need the EU more than they need us. That's the political reality.
Ian, I was struck before David Davis went to Brussels and he said he was going to get a deal like no other in history, which is
a really bad one.
It's slightly different to getting the best deal in history. I mean, it could be an historically
like the Versailles Treaty.
Like no other country could balls this up quite like we're going to.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, with the greatest respect, I just think it's completely overdone. I think our reading of it is far too narrowly British. I think the story of the last fortnight is that the European Union moved in the most interesting way possible on the future of the Eurozone and conceded essentially it wasn't going to take back all Eurozone clearing, which is the key thing which happens in Europe. London makes the Eurozone go round. It swaps, insures, trades all of the debt, which is why Germany still wants to have access to London. So the beginnings of a compromise of that emerged 10 days ago, and then Davis conceded yesterday, which I think we're in a slightly odd position if we're saying the government must concede and we must move towards a transition and we must soften towards EEA, not customs union, by the way, but the EEA, which I think is the position where we'll probably sensibly end up. And then Davis makes a concession in that direction. We said, well, disaster. We are useless. We can't do anything. We're moving, and both sides are moving, which is encouraging.
Isn't it possibly because if there's one thing this government is not good at, and obviously more than one.
Coordination, leadership.
Expectation management. And we saw it during the election campaign.
Yeah.
We were braced for a majority of 200.
Oh, look, I'm not here to make the case for this being a brilliantly well organised government. It's a complete shambles.
But saying this is going to be the row of the, don't build it up into this is going to be the row of the summer and then capitulate at the first. That's why it looks.
Yes,
bad.
But I mean, there's also in the second half of that stuff, there's then some stuff happening in parallel on trade, and there's also behind the scenes, the Eurozone stuff is happening, and that first paper has now gone off and is being discussed by other sort of stakeholders, terrible word, across Europe. And there's the beginning of the emergence of a compromise on access to the City of London and the City of London's access to Europe, because it's in mutual self-interest. And as I say, it's the number one thing which we don't talk about at all in the UK. We make their currency go round. The people who understand that more than any other, the Germans, the German finance ministry is obsessed by this. German papers have lots of reports about it, but you won't really read it much in the UK. There's going to have to be compromise. And I think actually the story of the last 2 weeks is that we're starting to see that one will probably emerge. And I don't think there will be hard Brexit.
Anne.
So is that the plan then? Sort of compromise?
You're asking Matt.
Well,
you might as well.
I ask, because this is
my seven-year-old. She might have some ideas.
Because this is a broader issue, because the public would like to know whether there's a plan. And if it's not to indulge in more psychodrama in the Tory party, but to be able to proceed submitting to the will of Mr. Barnier whenever, and it's capitulation or submission or kind of...
Compromise.
Is that the plan? Of course.
And that was... I have to say, it will be interesting to see when we get people's memoirs and when the papers emerge precisely how the policy was formed, which Jenny was saying Theresa May was arguing for a hard Brexit.
That was what she asked the country for a mandate. She didn't.
The position was that the government was prepared to walk away. Now, in terms of
But also from the single market and the customs union, I don't think it was that nuanced.
I thought that's what it was all about. You know, I didn't see any nuance in that. That's what the electorate thought. They were being asked to vote for a hard Brexit. They had moved on to other issues like social care, like housing, the NHS. Yeah, they weren't worried about Brexit. And when they heard hard Brexit, they thought, it's probably be bad for us. We think.
I mean, I really hope that Ian is right, because our only hope of doing well out of this is to go to the Europeans and be prepared to concede and make compromises and stop doing this ludicrous posturing like we're prepared to crash out or this is going to be the row of the summer. Because, of course, it's in Europe's interest and in ours. But our whole posture up to now under Theresa May has been aggressive, publicly aggressive. And it's really alienated people in Europe. I don't want to get into who started it business.
We end up then in the Fawlty Towers sketch about, you know, invading Poland. Yeah. So we're not going to go there at all. And I'm very, very, very pro-German. But if you think back to the aftermath of the referendum, and I'm a liberal, moderate leaver who had to be persuaded and thought about voting to stay. What should have happened after the referendum, and both sides are to blame, is that there should have been common ground between moderate leavers and moderate Remainers, which really amounts to, when you look at the polling and the practical political reality, about 70 to 80% of the country. But if you think of how that last year was characterised by Gina Miller, court cases...
Thank God for Gina Miller.
Well...
giving Parliament a voice.
But hasn't it made... I think the point is that it's made it more polarised.
It has. The aftermath polarised it. So you had the leading voices of ultra-Remain. I refuse to use the term Ramona because it's insulting, but ultra-Remain were essentially saying the public is stupid, they've got this wrong, they were lied to, which is the same as saying that they were stupid, that they didn't know what they were voting for, and that it must be stopped. I think in the most bizarre way possible, in a very British shambles, we might, and I emphasise there's a lot that can go wrong, we just might be edging towards a compromise out of this political
chaos. Well, I really
hope
so, because people like Philip Hammond, as we know, and Amber Rudd and Damian Green are all arguing within the government for a softer Brexit. And I'm only hoping that behind the scenes, that Theresa May, although she said nothing publicly, has understood that there is no mandate for a hard Brexit, that she must compromise with Europe in order not to end up with economic disaster, and that Europe is ready to listen to her, if only she will do that. But at the moment, we're not hearing anything publicly from her about the shift. And reportedly this week, Boris Johnson turned to her in cabinet and said, do you still hold to your Lancaster House speech, which was we're out of everything? And she said yes.
Well, on the subject of Theresa May, because I'm conscious of time, let's move on to Ian Martin taking a look at the Tory leadership.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think the question is if Theresa May is almost finished after the events of recent weeks, and I suspect she is. The Tory party, as the largest grouping in the House of Commons, is pretty soon going to have to identify a new Prime Minister. So then the question is, who on earth should it be? And it's not a long list of candidates. I think Boris is too much of a risk. His colleagues have concluded that. Personally, I think it should be David Davis. I'm aware of his flaws and failings, but I think he's tough. He's the son of a single mother, raised on a council estate, made by the territorial army, by education and by business. And I think, of those available, David Davis is up to the daunting challenge at the moment.
So, I mean, David Davis is in a prime position in that he's dealing with the biggest issue facing the country. So if and when Theresa May goes, you do need someone who can get a grip on Brexit. And so given that he spent the last 12 months reading into it and, you know, years before that thinking about it, that puts him ahead of other characters.
It does. And I think what's happening in the Tory party is that if someone had been the obvious choice, a Michael Heseltine figure perhaps, to think of November 1990, another Tory crisis, that person would probably have become Prime Minister the weekend after the election.
Yeah.
If William Hague had still been in the Commons, I think he'd be Prime Minister now. It looked for a little while as though Boris was trying to get something going. And the truth is he didn't really get any traction at all, and people are very, very sceptical about the idea of Boris as a candidate. So things have then drifted on, and I think I think we have to view it logically, which is that the Prime Minister is... her authority is completely gone. It is not impossible that that authority can be recovered or patched together in some way for a month. Some people even think 6 months. But it's inconceivable, surely, to see someone who's taken such an appalling knock to their confidence, who clearly doesn't want to be there and is staying there out of duty, which is to her credit, but really can't be Prime Minister for all that long. You then rapidly move on to the question of someone has to do it. So who is it? So the person, it is not a choice from a fantasy House of Commons choice of the perfect Prime Minister. Everyone who could potentially do it in the Cabinet, and I think it has to be someone from the Cabinet that the public has heard of. I don't think the Tories can try a complete, you know, who the hell's that outsider in the current public mood. That being the case, it pretty quickly whittles down to, I think, Boris and Davis. Other people might throw in Philip Hammond. I'm just simply not convinced by that. People would say Amber Rudd. I think her having a majority south of 400 is in her constituency is a real problem. Beyond that, unless I'm very wrong, some people are mentioning Greg Clark as a possibility, as a complete compromise. I think he's...
I like Greg, but the idea that all of this would end up with Greg Clark as Prime Minister
seems
extraordinary.
Do you know, I don't see any of those figures as having the qualities that we need currently in a leader. I think we are looking for somebody who can unite the nation, who looks as if they might be able to feel our pain, and also comes from a place where there wouldn't be a massive reason to dislike him, because from everybody who voted Remain will have a certain resentment towards David Davis. Agreeable chap though he is, with a ready wit. I'm just going to say the name Damian Green, de facto Deputy Prime Minister, remember, and who a man is known for being decisive. And I suspect that if Damian Green had stood there in North Kensington, Latimer Road, the area around the Grenfell Tower, on the morning after, he would have been able to summon the words that were necessary. Remember, he has got, and I know from people who worked with him when he was in television, He is very much in touch with what people want to know and want to hear. And I think that may be a quality that's not always essential in this role, but I think that's what we need right now.
He's, I think that's a very good point. He is a, he's a really, you know, top class operator. But you posed that question yourself, if he had done that the morning after, but he didn't.
He didn't.
And it was telling, actually, that Andrea Leadsom did. And as leader of the House of Commons, it's not technically her brief. And who knows, she might still... she may well still
I think he is,
of being
in terms of what's left of Mayism in the Conservative Party. I think Damian Green is the Prime Minister's candidate to succeed her.
Do you think that's what she was doing when she gave him that job of First Secretary of State?
I suspect so. It's purely supposition on my part, putting someone, an ally like that right there, so that if the stars align at some point in the next 6 months, she could then potentially hand over to him. I just have I have doubts about the Tory party having a following one Remainer who's crashed with another Remainer who's not necessarily known for his great leadership qualities or his toughness, which I think the Davis story, for all of his flaws, and he's taken some pretty eccentric decisions, including resigning for that mad by-election, which lots of people criticised him for. I did at the time, and fell out with him quite spectacularly. So he's capable of making mistakes. But if you wanted to connect with the kinds of voters who are worried now that Grenfell has collided with Brexit, and we have a country that's really deeply unhappy with itself, it's potentially... I just say of the available people there, David Davis, as someone who grew up on a council estate, who has a backstory, which is he would have absolutely, and he's a toughie, he would have no problem going and being booed and trying to engage with the crowd outside Grenfell Tower. I think of the available options, I think he's the best.
Aren't we looking though for a figure who can come up against Corbyn? We're thinking about somebody who, if there is an election, could be a contender.
This is the argument that the Boris camp have. You can only beat populists with a populist.
I think a grammar school boy, David Davis, from the School of Hard Knocks, might do rather well against the public school educated key Corbynistas like Schneider and Seamus Mill.
So, Jenny, are you a fan of David Davis, or have you got your eye on someone else to replace Theresa?
I think if it was obvious to the nation who should replace Theresa, she wouldn't still be there. Am I a fan of David Davis? I think David Davis is very entertaining. I think he's got a giant ego. I think he doesn't take a lot of things seriously. I think he's a show-off. I'm not sure that he would pay enough attention to the detail. I think he could alienate a great many people in the party with his peacockery. I mean,
but apart from that, he's great.
Apart from that, well, exactly.
I'm not sure he could fit all of that on his posters.
and of course, let's not remember, he went down in flames the last time he stood for the leadership. On the other hand, everybody else has tremendous flaws as well. Boris Johnson is a manipulative, conniving, unserious buffoon who doesn't even manage to follow his Foreign Office briefs or prepare himself in his meetings when he goes into meetings with his cabinet colleagues. He's alienated everybody with that. I think he would be a total disaster, because I think the only thing Boris Johnson ever thinks about is this good for me? Which is quite a short-term way to think about anything, but it's particularly unsuitable in a prime minister. Amber Rudd, quite good at politics. There are questions about whether she's good enough in operating the Home Office to be able to manage the brief of being a prime minister. Ruth Davidson reportedly doesn't want the job yet. I mean, God knows whether David Davis is the best, but I rather wonder whether you mightn't as well keep Theresa May, frankly.
Well, I will speak up for Amber Rudd, because I think Amber Rudd is a class act, and I interviewed her last year at the Tory Party conference on stage in front of a few hundred people, and she hadn't been in the job very long. Remember the job that she inherited from Theresa May, literally the worst job to have taken on in government. and was...
I found a terrible disaster in this department, which you've been running so brilliantly.
But I'm not going to change anything, don't worry, I'm not going to change anything. She likened it to buying a house from someone and them saying, oh, have you changed much? She said, no, I've left everything exactly the same. I've not even taken down the curtains. But she was very good. She had a very clear idea about what she did and didn't want to do, was quite happy to tell people like Boris Johnson, immigration is my thing, stop going to Australia and telling them that they can have free access to Britain Post Brexit and all that. And she talks like a normal person.
She does.
Which is a crucial... I think she's got... If there's one thing that we've learnt from Theresa May's premiership, is that actually... And Gordon Brown had exactly the same problem. People said, oh, well, you know, you're obsessed with personality and emotional intelligence. That's politics. That's part of what you've got to do. And I think somebody who... And I think David Davis ticks that box as well, but somebody who can be like a normal but can go on breakfast TV and engage with people and engage with a room full of people, I think it's really important.
She's just a little bit more Ariana Grande, and that's what we're looking for currently.
Well, that's what she should put on her posters. That's all we've got time for this week. As ever, you can sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes on your podcast app, so it arrives every week as soon as it drops. But for now, from Ian Martin, Anne Ashworth, Jenny Russell and me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.